Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decaledge podcast, a companion to the Decaledge blog. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. My guest today is Esteban Rodriguez. Esteban is the author of five poetry collections, most recently, The Valley and the essay collection Before the Earth Devours Us, both of which were released in 2021. He's the interviews editor for the Eco Theo Review, senior book reviews editor for Tupelo Quarterly, an associate poetry editor for AGNI. As you've probably come to expect, we talk a lot about how Esteban grew up and came to be a writer, as well as about his writing process. Esteban also reads a few of his poems, which is one of my favorite parts of interviewing poets. He's a prolific writer with a gift for place and emotion. I'm grateful for the time he was willing to spend and look forward to reading his future works. Please enjoy my conversation with Esteban Rodriguez. Esteban Rodriguez, welcome to the Decaledge podcast.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me.
I'm so glad to get a chance to talk with you. I did a conversation like this with Jason Myers some time ago, and you were one of the first people he recommended I reach out to. So I'm glad that we could do it.
Yes, definitely. And thank you to Jason as well. I'm pretty sure he'll be hearing this.
Well, why don't we begin at the beginning and kind of talk about where'd you grow up and how you grew up. I know that's a big part of your books, but maybe kind of set the stage and help us understand what that was like.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley, which is located in deep South Texas. When I was a undergrad, people would always ask me where I'm from, and I would say South Texas, and they would always be like, "Oh, San Antonio," and I was like, "No, you gotta go 6 more hours, traverse through purgatory, and then you'll arrive at the Rio Grande Valley." And so I grew up in a small town called Wessico, relatively new high school that was there. I was second high school, and I think I lived a pretty normal existence, as normal as anybody can live, I think. Although the definition of normal can change, right? Grew up a pretty good childhood, played basketball, did well in my classes. So I didn't have like necessarily anything that I think that I could stem to where like this one particular event that drew me to writing. I just always was fascinated with writing. And so, began shortly after I graduated college, which I went to UT Austin, and haven't looked back since.
What did you go to college to study?
Yeah, so that's I went to college to study Latin American studies and anthropology, which if you ask me if I do anything with those, I can't necessarily say directly, but indirectly, I think it prepared me. Those two particular majors prepared me for at least the more observational aspects of poetry or writing in general. I did want to be a studio arts major, but my parents dissuaded me from that. But little did they know that I was going to go on to make even less money with poetry. So
that's right. That's right. That's so funny.
Yeah, but they're super proud of my work right now. So
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. And so what was that childhood like? I mean, you portray it as you tell me now as pretty normal, pretty nuclear, but that's not necessarily what comes across in your writing, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, and that had to be like the poetic license I had to take when I first started writing this. What particularly why I wrote from like a perspective that wasn't necessarily as privileged as mine, or that it was more sort of a combination of other people's perspectives that I grew up with. Not that I didn't experience some of those things, like crossing the border every single weekend to get candy or get like food, or just even my grandmother getting alcohol, or just taking me to get a haircut. It was a very real part of the experience. And then knowing specifically, like I would spend weekends with some of my friends or some of my uncles, and they lived in these landscapes that just seemed very barren and very in need of a human touch to them. But part of the reason was because I was working as a tutor in a third grade class, an English class. And one of the assignments at the end of that semester was for students to write about Christmas. And they could write a poem, mm-hmm. they could write a short story, they had to draw pictures. And if you know anything about the Rio Grande Valley, you know how dry it is. And all these students ended up writing or drawing and writing about snow. And sort of its association with snow. And so they would draw these also like really grand buildings and these grand houses. And it was just not what was depicted growing up. And I felt that, like, why was that? Why were these kids so young trying to depict something that wasn't of their world, that they've seen in movies, they've seen in television, they've right. seen in magazines or just on YouTube. And I got really fascinated with that. And I ended up participating in the activity, and that's where I wrote Christmas, which is the poem in my first book. It was depicting a world that was a little bit more real to the one in which I grew up and in which these students were growing up in as well.
That's great. Sorry, I have spent just a little bit of time in the Rio Grande Valley, and like, if you haven't been there, you can't quite appreciate the environment. Mm-hmm. And the thing that always kind of gets me is there's parrots there.
Yes.
You know, it's very tropical. It's not what you think of as Texas, but a very, very beautiful place.
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of ribbing on like the whole purgatory thing earlier, but yeah. I think like you can never escape from where you came from, and I think like a lot of young people, and I was one of them, where it was this idea that like, oh, I had to get away, which is why I ended up studying in Austin and then now live in Central Texas, but and work in Austin. But even though I've tried to, I think physically, like, am elsewhere, dislocated from that particular place, it isn't dislocated from me, and it will always be a part of me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true for all of us.
Indeed.
And that comes out in your writing. I mean, not every piece of yours. And I guess we should say, current count, you've got 5 books of poetry published, a book of essays, and then a 6th book of poetry going to be released soon. Most of those tend to deal with your childhood and the Rio Grande Valley. And I guess I wonder, do you see a day where you embark on a writing project, you take on a book that isn't about that?
I think so. I'm hoping like one day to be able to do that. I think, who was it? José Saramago, the Portuguese novelist. I believe he didn't start writing novels till he was like in his late 40s, early 50s, okay. And wrote a bunch of poetry. So I'm hoping to get to maybe a novels in my future.
Oh, okay.
But I think I'm more interested, as I've gotten older and have a few books under my belt, knowing specifically that I've dealt with those themes and I've dealt with like memory and childhood and what it means to grow up in a particular place, I can move on a little bit, where I, the speaker of my poems can be a little bit older. And I think that's what I was trying to do with the chapbook that I have coming out, A City Is Always Near. I was trying to place myself in an older perspective, or at least a speaker, and I didn't have to necessarily be that young speaker that was the kind of threaded throughout the line of my earlier books.
Sure, sure. Let me ask you, you go to UT Austin. When you graduate, do you immediately begin writing poetry? When did that become kind of part of what you were working on?
Yeah, so I ended up, not immediately. I ended up graduating a semester early, didn't really know what to do, and then spent like a few months trying to find jobs. And it was really difficult to find something that I thought like I could see myself doing. And I ended up working at a coffee shop, a small coffee shop, no longer exists. It was called Savory Perks, but it did exist for a brief moment in time. And during my off days, I found myself wandering back into that coffee shop, either perusing the internet, looking for jobs, or writing. And that's when I began writing. And shortly thereafter, I kind of became pretty obsessed with it and began sending out these applications for MFA programs and got accepted to University of Texas Pan-American, which is now UTRGV.
What kind of pieces were you writing in that coffee shop? What were you attracted to at the time?
I was attracted to anything that can make me write like Hart Crane's specific poem, My Grandmother's Love Letters, which is the poem that has inspired me to write. And then just trying to write like a Hart Crane, which is very difficult. it came out really bad. So trying to be obscure while also being enlightening, as I think any young poet is trying to do, or any poet in general. But I can't say for certain what poems are there at that time. I do have poems in my Gmail, one of my folders, dating from 2012, which is a little in between when I was writing poems throughout my grad school experience, but I don't have anything before that. I didn't save it, which okay. I wished I would have.
Yeah. Would you read a poem for me?
Yeah, definitely.
I was going to ask if you would read kind of one of your earlier ones. Would you read Hands from Crash Course?
Yeah, let me just go ahead and pull this up real quick. Crash Course is I absolutely love that collection. But it came out almost like too close, I think, to my first one that I'm not sure if it has received the attention I think it should have received. But Hands. And when he grabbed my arm, pushed me against the wall, I thought of him at work, of the way his spine would bend, contort, invert new geometries, twist in angles I had never felt. I thought of his grip, of the decades of calluses, of how his palms resembled rust or tree bark, or the caliche splayed into a semblance of a road outside our house. And though I knew he had to use gloves, I pictured my father barehanded, moving bricks, rebar, lifting 2x4s and slabs of wood, conditioned to the repetition, weight, and to the pain that came when splinters pierced his skin. Or when something fell and he, caught off guard, had to stop it with his hands, the way I felt I had to stop him in the hall, keep him from my mother, bear not just the force of his heavy arms, but his excuse that he was only going to the bathroom, that he wanted nothing to do with that vieja, because if he did to her what his hands had done before, I'd later take it as my job to comfort her, to tend to what had swelled, and remind her as much as I would myself that there was more than one way for a body to be held.
Thank you for that. I wonder to what extent a poem like this, as you said before, is based on other people, and to what extent maybe it helps you understand your childhood. One of the things I think about, so I'm 46 years old now. One of the things I think about a lot is my misperceptions of events in my childhood with my parents or other people in my life, and how the way I understood an event then is different from how I understand that same event now. And so I wonder to what extent this poem and others that you've written are a way in which you come to a different understanding of your childhood. Is that fair, or am I reading too much into it?
That's definitely fair. So like, as I said before, a lot of the characters or the speaker is a combination of smorgasbord, if you will, of different people that I've met in my life. And then also my experiences taking with other people's experiences. The father based in this poem in Hands is not my biological father. I never knew my biological father beyond like a few memories in a picture, but it was my stepfather, which is my half-sister's father. And he was the one who was quite abusive and quite drunk. And so it was a big contrast to my other stepfather, who came into our lives when I was in middle school, because he is the complete opposite, but he is definitely the worker, works in construction still. And so for poetic sake, I was trying to find a way in which to blend the two stepfathers, essentially. And it doesn't do any justice, I think, to my current stepfather, Pete, because he is totally not that man, but it makes it so much easier in terms of like creating the narrative. And I think that helped me a lot in terms of like reconnecting with past memories that I think didn't, that I was kind of keeping under the rug and I didn't want to bring to light. And this particular part, this poem, for example, helped unearth that, right? Helped unearth sort of the trauma that my first stepfather put through, my mother through, put us through. And just sort of the way in which he kind of created, he made my mother's life not the best during that particular point in her life. And I think that was kind of pretty amazing to know that like poetry can do that as opposed to something like fiction, right? Where I can create this particular narrative throughout the course of the book and just continue it from book after book.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about your writing process, if you would. What does that look like for you?
Right now, it's almost non-existent because of schedules. But it's usually, I'll start off with a theme towards what I want a book to be about and then work towards that. And then sometimes the book will fall through just because it just doesn't have enough poems or the poems don't come together in the way in which I wanted them to. But I work towards a project all the time. I don't try to tend to stray from that. If I'm going to write something, I want it to be part of something larger and I want to make sure that it's included in something. So, on a day-to-day basis, I usually write like on my phone. I do have like the notes section. So you'll see, like this particular part, you probably can't see it.
Well, yeah, I
can't.
This
is a podcast. Nobody's going to see it.
It's okay. I can see it. Yeah.
But if I have a few minutes to write poetry, I'll just write the poems there and then just go back and constantly revise it. And then when I'm done, I'll send it to myself and make additional edits and revisions on a Word document, then save it and then store it in some sort of file or folder that I won't look at for a few months before I decide like, hey, I've had enough poems for a collection or for something to string along to be a collection, to be something more than just itself, and I'll put it together. When it's with prose, however, I, with the exception of probably reviews, I have to write longhand first. Like it just,
yeah.
I have to make sure that it goes longhand and then I'll type it out, which is the more tedious part about this whole thing is the typing out of all you've written for months is just, it's tremendous.
So my preference is always to write a first draft in longhand as well, but I'm curious what you think that, what do you get from that?
Yeah, I think for me, I get more thoughts that wouldn't have been easily accessible if I just open a Word document or a Google Doc. I think when I see the page, maybe it's just a mindset or a thing, a mentality thing. But when I see the page, I feel like on a doc or a Word doc, I feel like I have to be a little bit more perfect in there because I know that I'm putting something on there that is already for me like one more final step towards being something that's more real. Whereas opposed, if I write it longhand, I can more at liberty to make mistakes. And I want to make those mistakes because I want to see exactly where they go. I don't want to be perfect on the page just quite yet.
Yeah. So I want to go back to something you said a moment ago, which I found really interesting. So when you're writing poems, you're writing them with the intent of a collection. You have some idea of a collection and you're writing poems specific for that. Is that, did I hear that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And so that's very different than the other poets I've been fortunate enough to talk to. In general, they just tend to write poems and at some point go back and think, do I have enough for a collection here? How do I pull these out? So how did you come across that process? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I think I came across the process because when I was working on my first book, I was just really kind of writing poems and seeing what sticks. Mm. And then what happened was that after that first book, I started writing more poems and was kind of trying to maybe think I could gather it into a collection. But then I realized that I had about 20 poems that didn't make that first collection that fit in well with the themes that I was working with. And it became eventually the book In Bloom. And I felt that like I salvage poems that otherwise wouldn't have made it to the page. And I wanted to continue doing that. And I wanted to not have one particular stray poem that didn't have a purpose, that lived beyond just like the folders of my inbox. And so it also helped ground me a little bit more in terms of like producing books. It made it so much more fun, at least for me. I almost saw it as a puzzle. Like, hey, I have this title, I have a few poems, I know what the sections are going to look like. Now I just got to fill it in with these poems, and I gotta make it all fit and work it to a way that feels kind of organic, but at the same time, very purposeful.
So what is the genesis of a collection or a project look like for you? Where does that come from? How do you frame it in your mind?
Generally, it starts with the title. The poems that are coming out in the chapbook, A City Is Always Near, from Pole City Press, they are poems that I'm working for a book titled The Cities Where the Moon Says I Love You. And I mentioned this with Han Vanderhart in the podcast, but I just total riff off of Frank Sanford's book length collection, The Battlefield Where the Moon Says I Love You. And so I'm just working towards that. So it's all based off of the cities my wife and I have traveled, whether it's through vacation or just random places, and then the spaces in between those cities and what it means to find oneself in the middle of, what do you call it, Wyoming, not knowing the people around you, and stopping at a gas station and being fascinated that you hear English accents because it's the middle of Wyoming, and you're like, what in the world? So it definitely starts with the title, and then I work my way from there, and then seeing if I can get some pieces to fit, to stick. And then those that don't make the cuts, I try to see later on if they fit in elsewhere.
Okay. And so you've been pretty prolific, it would seem. Do you feel like kind of being focused in your work like that helps that?
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. If I wasn't focused, I wouldn't have the books that I do now. I think like I just have to. Yeah, I work towards that project because I want, in much the same way, I think that like that fiction writers, right? They'll work towards a particular plot or a particular narrative that they're working on for their novel. I want to do the same thing, except for poetry collections. I believe it might have been Faulkner that said, all novelists are failed poets. And I like to believe maybe the opposite is true with me. I'm a failed novelist, and that's why I turned to poetry.
That's great. One of the things I think I've observed in your poetry collections is your first couple were kind of almost typical poetry collections, but your later ones, I feel like they've become more experimental. So you begin to play with the layout of words on the page, in the valley. There's no punctuation anywhere. There's no capitalization anywhere. The chapbook, A City Is Always Near, kind of a different play on all of these different towns. So am I reading that right? Are you beginning to experiment and play a little more?
I think so. Although the next collection that comes out, Ordinary Bodies, is very kind of much more like Crash Course, I would say, or Inplume. But I think I have a few more books under my belt to where I can definitely experiment a little bit more. The Valley with the punctuation, I was reading way too much W.S. Merwin. and so it was a good challenge for myself to see if I can still maintain the lyricism of a line without the help of a comma or a period. And I think the only punctuation that shows up in The Valley is a colon or colons. But very few and far in between. But I would like to experiment a little bit more. One of the things that I think has helped me is these photographs.
Yeah. Talk a little about that.
Yeah. So in The Valley, it has a number of photographs, from places all along the border in the Rio Grande Valley. And when I first came up with the idea of the collection, this is like, so this going back to the original thing, right? I try to salvage all the poems. All the poems that are titled Recuerdo in this collection are poems that never made the cut for other books. They just, for some reason, they weren't fully fleshed out, and they didn't work with the themes, I think, quite yet. I ended up revising them. And in all the poems with the names of cities, those were the newer poems. When I conceived the collection, I thought this would be pretty cool to have like actual pictures, right? A lot of people don't know where the Rio Grande Valley is, and what better way to show them, not only through words and through images, but through actual photographs. And so I was living in Austin, and my sister had just graduated nursing school, I believe. My mother had just retired, and it was like, hey, I got a project for you. Here are the exact places I want you guys to take photographs of. And they went to those exact places and took photographs. And that's something that I've started to incorporate a little bit more. So in the next collection that comes out, there are photographs as well that I asked my mother and my father to take, my stepfather to take, for inclusion in the book. And it became a little bit more collaborative. And I think that was pretty amazing, to where I can bring other people in, and they could influence the way I'm writing. And then I hopefully can influence some sort of part of their lives when they see the collection fully fleshed out.
I love that. Would you read McAllen from the Valley?
Yeah, most definitely. So for some context, McAllen is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the second largest city in the Valley. But it'd always be a place that my family and I would go. And there's a little part called Little Mexico, where they have just a bunch of like shops and stuff. And we would travel there pretty much like every other weekend just to see what we could find.
Kind of like going to the big city.
Yes, indeed. This is McAllen. In Little Mexico, she says, Tienen dresses ahí. And after my cousin smiles, nods, and says thank you to my mother, she looks at me, asks if I want to shop for my quinceañera too, which I laugh at, and she laughs at, and I laugh at more, until we arrive in Little Mexico. And after shopping at a store after store after store, I began to feel that I do, that months from now, when I turn 15, I'll want the gown, the ball room, the gathering of family and friends, the dance with my father, so he can acknowledge, even if the quince says I am, that although I'm not yet a man, I will be soon. And like my cousins, who at the end of the night will feel like someone else, I'll feel brand new. Or knew enough to not think about the daughter my mother never had, or that at celebrations like these, I'm sitting in the back, wondering if when my time comes, I'll have my cake and eat it too.
Thank you. This poem, it's a little painful, it's very touching, and it's funny too. But for people that don't know, would you explain what a quinceañera is?
Yeah, quinceañera is just kind of like your, it's almost like a sweet 16, except it's generally like in Mexican or Hispanic culture, where you would celebrate usually like a female's like 15th birthday. There are like quinceañeros where you do it with, where it's like a male version. But I don't think they're as common as you would see it in a quinceañera. So it's a really big deal. And it's a big party that the entire family gets invited to. And there's a lot of dancing. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of food. But yeah, it's a celebration of, I guess you could say, like a rite of passage to becoming a woman for a young girl.
So I've had the privilege of attending one, and so can appreciate all that goes into it. And so it's funny to me that like you're at least in the poem, your family's looking at you like, what, do you want one too?
Yeah.
It's just kind of funny.
Yeah. And in that particular part, little Mexico, I mean, you can find a whole bunch of like dresses and whatnot. But there's always like a shop for like quinceañera dresses specifically.
Which again, for people that don't know, I like the closest thing I can attribute it to is like a prom dress or almost a wedding dress. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, yeah, really elaborate. Let's talk for a minute about your most recent book, Before the Earth Devours Us, which is essays. So what motivated you to begin writing essays or at least to publish a book of essays versus your poetry?
Yeah, so I started those essays when I was right after, kind of towards the end of grad school and after grad school. And it was really just a practice for me, like just to experiment with another genre and just write to see if I can flesh out things that I wasn't necessarily fleshing out in my poetry. And it definitely provided a lot of room for that. But this started in, I want to say 2013, and then just kind of on and off working through it. The last essay in the collection, Duel, was supposed to be much longer, but when I read through everything and looked at all the essays, there's 8 essays in the collection, and I looked through them and reread them and did a few revisions, I was like, hey, I actually have something. And I think it was really good that I sat on this for quite some time because it allowed me to digest what the essays had to offer. And it also allowed me to gain language that I didn't have when I was writing those essays. As a young person who just graduated grad school, like, and was writing poetry, I mean, I had a few publications to my name, but it wasn't anything big. And I was still experimenting with trying to find my voice, even though I think I was on the right track to finding my voice. And part of discovering your voice is discovering the language that you like. And I had some language that I liked at the essays, but it wasn't until I went back in my 30s, early 30s, that I found like, hey, I can actually revise this to a point that I really am satisfied with and that I think my younger self would have been satisfied with, but my younger self didn't have the language for at that time.
I see. And, you know, as you're writing these essays, are you writing them as simply as practice to begin working on another form? Are you trying to unpack something? How are you kind of thinking about that?
I'm trying to unpack memory as best as I can. And I think that's what the essays provide for me, a chance to be detailed, descriptive, and depict scenes in which in the best way that I can remember. And I don't think I always get it right, but I'm not trying to get it right. I'm trying to depict it as real as possible. I did a conference the other day and they asked about like, do you ever go back and when you try to publish like an individual essay as opposed to a collection, do you try to change some stuff? And I haven't had a lot of luck with that in terms of publishing individual essays. But I did think about one particular essay, Raptors, and I think that when I wrote this, the names have since changed of the velociraptors I describe. And I thought about going back and changing it. I thought, no, that actually works pretty well because that's exactly what I wrote during that time. And that's what I wanted to remain as.
Yeah, that essay was really fun for me to read. I think the one I like the most, though, and maybe it's just the way I'm wired, was Pallbearers.
I think that might have to be my favorite one as well. Yeah.
It's just so interesting that that dynamic. Again, it's a little funny in the midst of sadness. And anyway, it was a pleasure to read.
I'm glad you see the humor in these things. I think a lot of the I always try to be humorous in the collections. Now, I work as a counselor and I help students through like the college application process here in Austin. I have a caseload of students and I'm always just making that, I'm not a dad, but I'm always just like making dad jokes and trying to be funny with them. So I think like just in general, I try to find like the humor in all things. And I'm glad that you can see that in the actual essays or even in the poems, right? Where there's like a hint of humor, but you can also have sadness, nostalgia. You can have a variety of different emotions attached to one particular thing.
Well, and it's such a universal, I think, universal human thing where you're in this space, you're in this time, this event, especially when you're with your siblings or your cousins, and it's supposed to be somber and it's supposed to be sad and you're supposed to be, you know, very grown up, and somebody says something and you all bust out laughing, or like, it's, that's just a very common natural human thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For listeners, in that essay, my grandfather passed away when I was pretty young, and him and my grandmother had 9 children. And of those 9 children, 6 of them, were my mother and then my aunts. And part of his will was that all his daughters had to, be the pallbearers to his funeral and had to carry the casket. And just witnessing this was quite immense. But at the end, there was so much confusion and just so much emotion that all my cousins and I ended up taking a limo and just kind of, it was almost like a joyride, but unbeknownst to us, like, we had no adult supervision and ended up back in my grandmother's house. And we were just, this was like the greatest feeling, right? To be in a limo at such a young age, but also in the backdrop was my grandfather's death and funeral.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. So you've mentioned, you know, we've talked about A City Is Always Near. You've sort of hinted at a couple of other projects. What other work can we expect from you, and when can we expect it?
Yeah, I think, so I do have the collection Ordinary Bodies that will appear in February with Word West Press. That particular collection is centered on just dissecting, a young speaker dissecting what it means to like have a body, what it means to look at other bodies, specifically those of his family. And that one, again, does include like the photographs of my mother and father. And then I do have another collection that will also come out looking towards like the middle of summer with Flower Song Press called Limbolandia. And Limbolandia is kind of a little bit like part two of my third collection, Displacement. So centers on similar themes, more surrealist bent to it, and just looking at the ways in which people traverse borders in order to arrive at a much better place, whatever that place may be. And then I'm working on an essay titled Nayarit. It's supposed to be a pretty long essay. I'm shooting for about 120 pages, but it's about me traveling to Nayarit, Mexico, which is in the south of Mexico, for one of my best friend's weddings. I was his best man, and just like the whole journey of it, and thinking back to it and what it meant to kind of try to reconnect with your cultural path, cultural heritage as much as possible, but also navigating a landscape that is full of uncertainty and just so rich in culture. And hopefully I can get that done looking towards the end of the year. But I have all these new ideas for essays that I want to work on. So I'm kind of shifting a little bit of focus, still working on the poetry, but not feeling that urgency that I might have felt producing so many books in such a small time frame.
Sure, sure. That's great. Esteban, tell me about your work at Ecotheo Review. What are you doing there?
Yeah, I'm the interviews editor there. And that job has been quite amazing, to say the least, the amount of great writers I've been able to interview. I ended up meeting Jason, I think through maybe just like how a lot of writers meet through Twitter. And he lived in Austin while I lived in Austin. We met at the public library, and he said, hey, like, we have this position and this is kind of our focus, and I would like to steer it this way. And I first started off as really focusing on these micro essays about debut writers focusing on their genesis of their collections, their debut collections. But it's since evolved to include a variety of different writers. I tend to focus a little bit more on poetry just because of my poetic background, but I do work with a variety of different writers. I just interviewed Natasha Dayon, which she judged our fiction contest, and she has a new book coming out. I believe it might be out tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, called The Perishing. I highly recommend it. It's about a young Black female reporter who is in 1930s Los Angeles, but it looks like she might be kind of immortal. And so she just moves across time periods. So it's a pretty good read. And her first novel, Grace, was amazing. But I've been able to interview amazing people, Gregory Pardlow, Joel McSweeney, just did an interview with Kimberly Ann Priest, and then finishing off a few with Jesus Castillo and Daniel LaSalle.
That's great. That's great. Thanks for sharing that. Esteban, tell me about the last book you read.
Yeah, the last book I read, I finished it last night. The Years, Months, Days by, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, by Chinese novelist Yan Liangqi. I bought a book for my mother. My mother visited this past weekend. We used to do a book club at the beginning of the pandemic, but my schedule got pretty busy, and I definitely want to start that back up again. So I bought her the book, and it's composed of two novellas. And Yan Liangqi is a Chinese novelist, but he's also a satirist. And so his works can be highly satirical, but I believe some of his books are banned in China, or were banned in China. And then there was a lot of self-censorship that he did as well in order to get his books published. But a contender for the Nobel Prize every year. And I'm really digging his work immensely.
That sounds great. I'll have to check it out. Would you read one more poem for me? Would you read something from A City Is Always Near?
Yeah, let's go with, I think it's Frankfurt. Yes. Frankfurt. At the Adolf Wagner, you asked for blood sausage, and the server, in English, his tone clearly has contempt for, ask if you're sure, if you know what you're ordering, if by any chance you ever had this before. And of course, to save face, you say yes, yes, you have. And the server, skeptical of your body language, response, nods, walks away. You see him laugh at a table nearby. Imagine he's cracking jokes at your expense. And you can't help but think of your father, how at restaurants back in Texas, he tenses up, says when the server asks for drinks, tea, sweet tea, please, but with Spanish still heavy on his lips, still fatigued with uncertainty, diaspora, with thinking that once he crossed over, his tongue would have a newfound confidence, and he'd speak like you speak now, sharp with every consonant, tender with every vowel.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, this is a true story. That one's like as autobiographical as it could get.
I can totally see it. Esteban, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your
thank you. Thank you so much, Matthew. I really appreciate everything.
Yeah, thank you for your transparency and for your work. It really matters.
I really appreciate that. Yeah. And I hope your listeners enjoyed everything as well, and got to hear some poetry that they might not have otherwise heard before.
Just a few quick things before you go. As always, I'm grateful for you listening and reading. It means a lot to me. If you'd like to support the podcast, please subscribe to it on iTunes or Spotify. Rating or commenting on the show would be great too. You can also subscribe through the website so you get my writing as well. And did you know the Decaledge is an online bookstore? There's a link at the top of the website where you can find nearly all of the books that we review or discuss. Maybe most importantly, if you're enjoying the show, is to tell a friend about it. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website or via Instagram at @the_decal_edge. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro and ending music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, the Darmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless.